Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, June 11th, 2021. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson opens the G7 summit in Cornwall, England, with a message for world leaders to learn lessons from the coronavirus pandemic and not repeat mistakes of what he called the last big economic recession, 2008, when the recovery was not uniform across all of society. Justice Department in the U.S., the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, says his office will investigate the Justice Department's handling of a leak investigation under former President Trump. This following the New York Times report, the department subpoenaed phone metadata of Democratic lawmakers, staff, and some family members. Attorney General Merrick Garland declaring expansion of voting rights a central pillar to U.S. democracy and warning states that have passed voting reform bills the federal government doesn't think will expand rights but actually restrict them, that his department will be challenging that. And the winner of the 2020 Pulitzer Prizes for Journalism announced today a special award to Darnella Frazier, the teenager who recorded George Floyd's death on video. Story filed by UPI. President Joe Biden joined other world leaders in Britain at the G7 summit on Friday as they prepared to discuss a range of issues that included the coronavirus pandemic, global warming, free trade, and challenges in dealing with China and Russia. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson kicked off the first plenary session, welcoming the participants and stressing the importance of the gathering.
Can you hear me, everybody? Can I begin by welcoming everybody to Carbis Bay? And thank you all very much for coming. It is genuinely wonderful to see everybody in person. I can't tell you what a difference it makes. We've all been going through the most wretched pandemic our countries have faced for our lifetimes, maybe longer, much longer. And I actually think this is a meeting that genuinely needs to happen, because we need to make sure that we learn the lessons from the pandemic. We need to make sure that we don't repeat some of the errors that we doubtless made in the course of the last 18 months or so. And we need to make sure that we now allow our economies to recover. And I think that they have the potential to bounce back very strongly. And there's all sorts of reasons for being optimistic. But it is vital that we don't repeat the mistake of the last great crisis, the last great economic recession in 2008, when the recovery was not uniform across all parts of society. And I think what's gone wrong with this pandemic, or what risks being a lasting scar, is that I think that inequalities may be entrenched. And we need to make sure that as we recover, we level up across our societies and we build back better. And I actually think that we have a huge opportunity to do that, because as G7, we are united in our vision for a cleaner, greener world, a solution to the problems of climate change. And in those ideas, in those technologies, in which we're all addressing together, I think there is the potential to generate many, many millions of high-wage, high-skill jobs. And I think that is what the people of our countries now want us to focus on. They want us to be sure that we're beating the pandemic together and discussing how we'll never have a repeat of what we've seen, but also that we're building back better together and building back greener and building back fairer and building back more equal and in a more gender neutral and perhaps a more feminine way. How about that, apart from anything else? So those are some of the objectives that we have before us at Carbis Bay. Thank you all very, very much. I'm now going to ask our friends from the media very, very kindly to leave us to our deliberations, which by tradition, this is meant to be a fireside chat between the great democracies of the world. It's turned into a gigantic media circus in which we have to greet each other several times.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson joined at the round table with the leaders of the United States, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan. Also represented at the meeting, Australia, South Africa, and South Korea, and India, taking part remotely due to COVID-19. Earlier, as the leader and their partners met on the beach for the traditional family photo, First Lady Jill Biden joking, "I feel like we're at a wedding." Prime Minister Johnson agreeing, saying the procession resembled walking down the aisle. Also today, Jill Biden went with Kate Middleton, Duchess of Cornwall, member of the British royal family, to a local state-funded school that works with 4- and 5-year-olds who have dealt with trauma.
Thank you, everyone, for being here today and from overseas as well. But I wanted to just say a personal thank you and welcome to you, Dr. Biden. It's a huge honour to welcome you here in the United Kingdom. And I hope you'll enjoy the discussion today, and thank you for your interest in this work. So I'm very much looking forward to today's conversation. Thank you.
Thanks. And I want to say thank you for everybody for this program today. Thank you to the Academy. I met some wonderful teachers and principals and most of all, the children who were so inspiring and so well-behaved. I know I couldn't get over it. But I want to thank the press, too, for covering this, because early childhood education is so important to lay the foundation for all of our students. So thank you for having me and for inviting me here. It's a very special place, I can see that.
First Lady Jill Biden and Kate Middleton, Duchess of Cornwall, at the Connor Downs Academy, Hale, Cornwall, England. Later, Queen Elizabeth herself came to the G7 meeting there to host a dinner for the leaders. The G7 meeting between the leaders continues on Saturday. Some of the expected joint announcement at the end, there are news reports already on it, a pledge of 1 billion coronavirus vaccine doses donated to lower-income countries, half of that from the U.S. President Joe Biden announced on Thursday a pledge of 500 million doses. Another thing expected, a call for a new transparent investigation by the World Health Organization into the origins of COVID-19, and also a global minimum 15% corporate tax. Also this from the White House today, saying that German Chancellor Angela Merkel will be visiting President Biden at the White House in Washington on July 15th. As we've been discussing all week, next week, President Biden meets one-on-one with the Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva. And one topic sure to come up, ransomware cyber attacks. This as U.S. intelligence agencies say many of the criminal gangs behind recent attacks on U.S. government and businesses are based in Russia. Today, Congressman John Katko, top Republican on the House Homeland Security Committee, was asked about what President Biden should be saying to President Putin.
If we don't have a proportional or a disproportionate response, and I think previous presidents are guilty of it as well. I don't think they fully appreciated the threat that that's in the cyber realm. And I don't think they fully appreciated China. You know, China's got a 100-year plan. They got a 50-year plan. They want to dominate the world. And I think, going into them and trying to work diplomacy, they don't understand it. Bad guys only understand strength and power. If I walked into a guy and I said, we got some pretty good stuff on you, so you should plead guilty and cooperate against all your buddies. The guy would be like, screw you. But went in and said, here's the evidence I have, laid it all out, and if you don't do it, you're going to die in prison. You want to cooperate, or do you want to die in prison? That's the type of strength we need to project, and that's what we're not doing now. And that's why I think, like I said, raising CISA's profile, to keep it on an even keel with DOD and with the intel community, and then have the head coach, if you will, being in the National Cyber Command director, who can look at all that defensive and offensive capabilities, properly advise a president, when we should do it, but also making sure that the president understands that cybersecurity is our preeminent threat, and if we don't fight back, this is like a new arms race in the world. In my mind, it's a new nuclear arms race, right? This is a new Cold War, and if we don't elevate it to that and understand that is the threat, we are sadly mistaken. And so when you go to see guys like Putin, he sizes you up, and he's an old KGB guy, like I said. He better project strength, or they're not going to be intimidated, and they're going to continue to screw with us. And we have to project strength here, and I think we have to make some examples of people when they do something.
Congressman John Katko, top Republican on the House Homeland Security Committee, former federal prosecutor targeting organized crime. Today, a virtual discussion on cybersecurity was hosted by the American Enterprise Institute. This topic also coming up at a House Armed Services Subcommittee hearing today, testifying the director of the National Security Agency, General Paul Nakasone, and Republican Congressman Austin Scott with this question.
Admiral Stavridis, if I've got that correct, said Trump got a space force, Biden should get a cyber force. The administration should create a full-fledged cyber force. We're overdue for an elite independent branch of the armed forces in which all the personnel wake up every morning thinking about defending the nation in cyberspace. Do you agree or disagree with that, General? I mean, should we establish a cyber force? I mean, Fort Gordon is in my state, not too far from where I live, and just open to suggestions with that. And I am open. I'm open to the creation of a cyber force if that helps us better carry out the mission.
Congressman, thank you for that question, and I appreciate Admiral Stavridis' thoughts on that. Here's what I've experienced over 10 years working within cyber. Our focus right now is developing the 133 teams that U.S. Cyber Command has. As the NSA director and the commander of U.S. Cyber Command, the most important thing we can do is to continue to have outcomes, positive outcomes that we've seen with forces like Army Cyber, of which I used to command, that's headquartered at Fort Gordon. My concern with moving towards a cyber force right now is the infrastructure, the other elements that take away from what we want. We want the best cyber operators working mission every single day. And I think we have that based upon the experiences that I've had and also the outcomes that we've seen in the past two elections.
Okay. Well, I guess what can you explain? You said the past two elections. What are you alluding to with that?
Yes, in 2018, one of the things that that we took on across both NSA and U.S. Cyber Command was to come together onto an organization that I called the Russia Small Group that was focused on ensuring we would not have influence or interference in our midterm elections. We took the same approach in 2020. And so being able to ensure that adversaries operating outside the United States could not impact through influence operations was one of the things that was clearly what we focused on. We had great success in both elections.
National Security Agency Director General Paul Nakasone before the House Armed Services Committee, questioned by Congressman Austin Scott. Congresswoman Karen Maloney, who chairs the House Oversight and Reform Committee, has written a letter to the meat processing company JBS asking for an explanation to why the company paid $11 million in ransom to a criminal hacking group, R Evil. Maloney writing, "Any ransom payment to cyber criminal actors like R Evil sets a dangerous precedent that increases the risk of future ransomware attacks." This is Washington Today. From CNN, the Justice Department's Inspector General will investigate the department's handling of a leak investigation into former President Donald Trump's political enemies that included a subpoena to collect metadata of lawmakers, staff, and some family members. The activity follows the bombshell revelation that prosecutors in the Trump administration Justice Department subpoenaed Apple for data from the accounts of House Intelligence Committee Democrats, along with their staff and family members, as part of a leak investigation. Prosecutors were looking for the sources behind news stories about contacts between Russia and Trump associates. That from CNN. One of the Democrats, Eric Swalwell of California, and he was interviewed on CNN Friday morning.
This isn't really about me or Chairman Schiff. This is about everyday Americans, you know, who don't want to see their government weaponize law enforcement against them because of their political beliefs. And I hope Trump supporters who fear Big Brother see that Donald Trump was the biggest brother we've ever seen in our country, who did weaponize this to go all the way down the stack into, you know, the private communications of people he perceived as political opponents.
This happened at a time, and CNN's reporting as well, that the Trump administration, the president himself, fixated on the investigation into his teams, his associates' contacts with Russians. And the president's public comments at the time, we know those. We know his focus and how upset it made him. Do we know what initially sparked this investigation under then-Attorney General Sessions? Is it the president's interest, the president's focus there? Have you been told anything, or can you glean anything again from what was seized here?
That's what Chairman Schiff is asking, and I support. Inspector General report into, you know, just who ordered this, who went along with this, why it continued for so long when nothing was turned up what the president wanted. I'll tell you what we turned up in our House intelligence investigation that the president didn't like. We showed that the president sought help from Russia, benefited from help from Russia, planned on receiving help from Russia, and as president governed as somebody who put Russia ahead of the United States. We proved that. But the allegations that there were leakers on the Intelligence Committee, this case is closed, and he certainly didn't prove it other than that he was willing to abuse power to try and smear an opponent.
Well, let me ask you that directly. Did you at any time leak any classified information regarding that or other investigations?
No, never.
Congressman Eric Swalwell on CNN with Jim Sciutto, the other Democrat targeted. He referenced him, Adam Schiff. Also from California, Adam Schiff now chairs the House Intelligence Committee. And Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer and Whip Dick Durbin now demanding that former Attorneys General Bill Barr and Jeff Sessions under President Trump testify about this before the Judiciary Committee or be subpoenaed if they refuse. The two leaders calling what has been alleged shocking and a gross abuse of power. Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking today about voting rights, announcing some new actions by the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. Reuters says that Garland's remarks come at a time when many Republican-led states are tightening voting laws in a manner that critics say will make it harder for Black and Hispanic voters to participate. Here's the Attorney General at the Justice Department in Washington.
Today, I am announcing that within the next 30 days, we will double the division's enforcement staff for protecting the right to vote. We will use all existing provisions of the Voting Rights Act, the National Voter Registration Act, the Help America Vote Act, and the Uniform and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act to ensure that we protect every qualified American seeking to participate in our democracy. We are scrutinizing new laws that seek to curb voter access. And where we see violations, we will not hesitate to act. We are also scrutinizing current laws and practices in order to determine whether they discriminate against Black voters and other voters of color. Particularly concerning in this regard are several studies showing that in some jurisdictions, non-white voters must wait in line substantially longer than white voters to cast their ballots. We will apply the same scrutiny to post-election audits to ensure they abide by federal statutory requirements to protect election records and avoid the intimidation of voters. In that regard, we will publish guidance explaining the civil and criminal statutes that apply to post-election audits. And we will likewise publish guidance with respect to early voting and voting by mail. And because the upcoming redistricting cycle will likely be the first since 1960 to proceed without the key preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act, we will publish new guidance to make clear the voting protections that apply to all jurisdictions as they redraw their legislative maps. Under the supervision of the Deputy and Associate Attorneys General, the Department will implement its responsibility under Presidential Executive Order 14019, promoting access to voting. Those include ensuring access to voter registration for eligible individuals in federal custody. They also include assisting other federal agencies in expanding voter registration opportunities as permitted by law. We will also work with Congress to provide all necessary support as it considers federal legislation to protect voting rights. Although we will not wait for that legislation to act, we must be clear-eyed. The Shelby County decision eliminated critical tools for protecting voting rights. And as the president has said, we need Congress to pass S1 and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which would provide the department with the tools it needs. We will also partner with other federal agencies to combat election disinformation that intentionally tries to suppress the vote. Finally, we have not been blind to the dramatic increase in menacing and violent threats against all manner of state and local election workers, ranging from the highest administrators to volunteer poll workers. Such threats undermine our electoral process and violate a myriad of federal laws. The criminal section of the Civil Rights Division, together with the Department's National Security and Criminal Divisions, the 93 United States Attorneys, and the FBI, will investigate and promptly prosecute any violations of federal law.
Attorney General Merrick Garland at the Justice Department. Up on Capitol Hill, House Administration Subcommittee on Elections held a hearing on voting rights today. The focus was on polling locations. In his opening statement, Republican Brian Stile, the ranking member of the subcommittee, talked about that and the overall issue of voting rights reform.
We'll hear from today's witnesses about how H.R. 1 would nationalize all elections and centralize their administration in Washington, D.C., under Democratic control, who has a history of closing polling locations and removing key safeguards like voter ID or list maintenance that protect our elections and help ensure voters are confident in the process and the results. Last Congress, Republicans introduced legislation to help states ensure polling locations could remain open. The Emergency Assistance for Safe Elections Act, the EASE Act, would have provided additional funding to help states and localities to help poll workers disinfect equipment for voting machines, purchase personal protective equipment for poll workers, and other items. The EASE Act would have also addressed an issue election administrators across the country struggle with, which is recruiting enough poll workers. The typical poll worker is 65 years or older, which is admittedly the designated at-risk population for COVID. Even outside of the pandemic, recruiting poll workers has been increasingly difficult for election administrators. The EASE Act would have provided funding to help states clean their voter registration rolls, which impact voter wait times. The more outdated the voter rolls, the longer it takes poll workers to find a voter in the system. There are, I think, really common sense solutions that don't involve a federal government takeover of our election system. And unfortunately, we were not able to review the bill in this committee, and Speaker Pelosi never brought the bill to the floor for a vote. I believe there are election administration solutions Democrats and Republicans can work on together, and I'm hopeful that my colleagues on the committee will take me up on addressing some of them.
Congressman Brian Stile, Republican, ranking member of the House Administration Subcommittee on Elections, from today's hearing. You can find it and all of C-SPAN's programming in full at our website, cspan.org. He referred to H.R. 1, that's the Democratic Written Voting Rights Bill that passed the House. The companion in the Senate is S-1. Its fate still uncertain because the Senate has the filibuster, would need 10 Republicans to join it. That is extremely unlikely. Or a key Senate Democrat, Joe Manchin, who has so far opposed it. And that would mean that he's not supporting getting rid of the filibuster in order to pass it. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. The new Israeli government that will be ending Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year run as prime minister has signed its final coalition agreements that include term limits. Coalition also includes, for the first time, a party from Israel's Arab minority. It takes power on Sunday. Here in the U.S., the Pentagon restoring $2.2 billion to military construction projects that were taken by the Trump administration to pay for the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. And the Food and Drug Administration says about 60 million doses of the single-shot Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine produced at that troubled plant in Baltimore must be thrown out. But another 10 million doses from the plant will be allowed to be distributed with a warning that the FDA cannot guarantee they were produced using good manufacturing practices. As the days count down to President Joe Biden's 4th of July goal of having at least 70% of Americans getting at least one dose, one shot of the coronavirus vaccine, currently 64% have, the vaccine hesitant are being appealed to. Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser held what she called a fireside chat with Dr. Anthony Fauci, a member of the White House COVID-19 response team.
You probably heard every reason that somebody doesn't want to get a vaccine, and I'm wondering if you could help us with those responses. I've heard people say, I don't want to get that vaccine because it took them, you know, they didn't take long to develop it. It happened too fast.
All right. The answer to that is easy, Madam Mayor. The answer is the virus was discovered in January of 2020, and we had vaccine going into people's arms, a highly effective vaccine in December. That's 11 months. That is indeed the fastest in the history of any vaccine. But that wasn't rushing. What that was the reflection of the decades of basic and clinical research that antedated the development of the vaccine to allow us to hit the ground running. So we're very fortunate that we live in an era where we're reaping the rewards and the fruits of multiple years of investment in research. So we didn't rush it at all. It's just the manifestation of an investment in research.
So what do we say to people who say, I don't want to do it because Donald Trump was involved and I don't trust Donald Trump?
Well, we're not asking you to trust Donald Trump. I mean, we're asking you to trust the medical establishment. And the medical establishment, myself and my colleagues, thousands of us, thousands, not just me, feel very strongly that it is so important for your own protection and that of your family and your community to get vaccinated. Keep politics out of this. This is a medical issue. Whether you like or don't like a politician is irrelevant. This is a medical issue.
Dr. Anthony Fauci and Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. A headline at the Weather Channel website, California drought leads to mandatory water restrictions for millions. The article says that 85% of the state is in extreme or exceptional drought, and that Governor Gavin Newsom has declared an emergency for drought in 41 of the state's 58 counties. How to respond came up at a hearing here in Washington, D.C., at the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis. One of the witnesses was the Los Angeles mayor, Eric Garcetti. Here's the question from Republican Congressman Gary Palmer of Alabama.
Looking at California, the state of California's water policies and their failure to prepare adequately for the drought that you're in right now should be of great concern to all of the mayors in California. You had a major wet period in 2019, record amounts of snowfall. I think the snowpack was 153%. Yet because of the failure to prepare for the wet periods, you're really struggling in terms of your water capacity. How would you respond to that?
Sure, a couple things. One is it doesn't resonate as much in the city of Los Angeles because we've been preparing for a long time and it's not a switch you can just flip right away. We built out, for instance, a ton of stormwater capture so that when that snow melted, eventually made its way down into Los Angeles River and other places, we now have huge catch basins. I passed the largest water bond in at the local level in U.S. history as a council member that put $500 million into being able to really reinfiltrate that water into our natural aquifers. As I mentioned, too, we're taking something that's three times bigger than the L.A. aqueduct by taking our wastewater plant, where 60% of our water flows through, gets cleaned up, and then washed out to the ocean, the only place that doesn't need more water. And we're converting that into something that will give us enough water for decades to come. But I hear the point of what you're saying, and I do believe that both local, state, and federal government should be investing in that infrastructure, whether it's the WIFIA funds that are out there or other things of the longer term retention.
I want to ask some other questions of other members, but okay. I do appreciate that point you just made, that we do need to be investing in this, and California should have been doing this. I don't think there's been a new reservoir built in California since 1979. It not only would give you the water storage capacity, but also help mitigate against the flooding that you guys went through a couple of years ago.
Congressman Gary Palmer and Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, part of today's hearing of the U.S. House Select Committee, Subcommittee on the Climate Crisis. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 13, NASDAQ up 49, and S&P up 8. The Pulitzer Prizes were awarded today to journalists and news organizations in the U.S. for exceptional coverage in 2020. Winners announced by video for the second year in a row due to the coronavirus pandemic rather than at Columbia University. A special award went to the teenager who video recorded the Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck before he killed George Floyd.
The Pulitzer Prize Board is pleased to award a special citation to Darnella Frazier for courageously recording the murder of George Floyd, a video that spurred protests against police brutality around the world, highlighting the crucial role of citizens in journalists' quests for truth and justice.
Part of the video announcement with the co-chairs of the Pulitzer Prize Board, Aminda Marquez Gonzalez from the Miami Herald and Steven Engelberg of ProPublica. The award this year for public service, considered by some the most prestigious, went to the New York Times for its coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic, described by the board as prescient and sweeping. Thanks for being with us today on Washington Today. It's available as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts. And also get the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen wherever you go. Hope you have a good night and weekend.